This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to the Sam and Rose Stein Institute for Research on Aging's monthly public lecture series. For those of you I haven't had the chance to meet yet, my name is Danielle Glorioso, and I'm the Executive Director of the Stein Institute and the Center for Healthy Aging. At the Stein Institute, we are committed to advancing lifelong health and well-being through research, training, and community outreach. This public lecture series has been going on for over 30 years now, with the idea in mind that we want to connect the public with exciting advances that are happening here in aging at UCSD. As I mentioned, it's been going on for 30 years now, and it's been sponsored entirely through private donations. So I'd like to thank all of you for your continued support through the years to make this very special and unique event possible. For those of you who haven't gone to our website, you can find out more about all of our lectures and watch past lectures. We're at aging.ucsd.edu. So I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight. We are honored and privileged to have Dr. Rupali Gupta here with us. She is a primary care physician and assistant professor of medicine here at UCSD. She's a board-certified geriatric medicine doctor and provides primary care for older adults with an emphasis on health maintenance, disease prevention, and treatment of acute and chronic illnesses. We are honored to have her speak here tonight. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gupta.
Hi, and thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and to talk with you all. I thought I'd start with a little bit of background about myself. And in addition to what was already mentioned, I am a geriatrician, and I practice medicine at the Medicine for Seniors Clinic over at Perelman here at UCSD in La Jolla. And I am not a researcher, so I don't have one particular area within geriatrics that I study, but I am very involved with education on campus. I teach the geriatric medicine fellows, a few of which have come today, which is wonderful, as well as internal medicine residents, medical students, and other professions. And with my teaching, along with, of course, patient care, I have to stay up to date with literature in that way. So again, I'm thrilled that you are here today. I was going to talk about updates in clinical geriatrics staying healthy for year 2015. So I thought by just I'd start by just talking about the definition of geriatrics. The American Geriatric Society defines geriatrics as a branch of medicine that focuses on health promotion and the prevention of and treatment of disease and disability in later life. I'm actually going to focus specifically on health promotion and the prevention of diseases. One thing I was going to bring up is sometimes people ask me if I find it depressing at all in geriatrics, and I always say no, it's actually the complete opposite. I find it very inspiring to have patients make progress or make strides, whether they're on the more frail spectrum or on the more robust spectrum and independent and traveling the world. And I think that's one of the things I love is the heterogeneity of aging. So that's actually where I'm going to start, is what do I mean by the heterogeneity of aging? So this graph represents, well, for one, heterogeneity of aging is difference in life expectancy as patients grow older. This graph represents life expectancy for upper, middle, and lower quartiles for men and women at selected age groups. The top graph is life expectancy for women, with the y-axis representing years and the x-axis representing age. Each age is then stratified by quartile of health, and this is based on epidemiologic data. So, for instance, if you look at age, women in the age group of 70, those who are in the top quartile of health, which was represented by this black bar, have a median of approximately 21.3 years of life expectancy, while those who are in the lowest quartile of health, represented by this light bar, have a median of approximately 9.5 years of life expectancy. The point is, of course, not to memorize the numbers, but to just recognize that there's this huge range in terms of functional and physiologic differences in our aging patients, and that's so important when we're individualizing care decisions for both treatment as well as prevention. So what are the categories for disease prevention and health promotion? I thought I'd start by giving a framework for how we think about prevention in medicine and clinical care. Primary prevention aims at preventing development of disease. So the disease doesn't exist, we're trying to prevent development of that particular condition. Secondary prevention focuses on early detection and treatment of asymptomatic disease. And tertiary prevention focuses on preventing further morbidity or functional decline for established medical conditions. I'm going to start with primary prevention. And actually, for the purposes and scope of this talk, I'm going to stick to primary and secondary prevention. And the areas that I'd like to focus on are exercise, diet, and immunizations within primary prevention. So let's start with exercise. Clearly, it is not a new concept that exercise is beneficial for our health. I pulled this quote from circa 65 BC from Marcus Tullius Cicero, quote, "It is exercise alone that supports the spirits and keeps the mind in vigor." Specific benefits of exercise in aging, the list is clearly very long. I wanted to start general and then I'll go more specific with some studies. Reduced risk of developing cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, stroke, diabetes, osteoporosis, obesity, colon cancer, breast cancer, anxiety, depression, falls and functional limitations and cognitive decline. And we have data that suggests improvement in longevity with exercise. Again, this is way beyond the scope to go into data for each of these categories, but because I'm asked so much about cognitive decline and how do I keep my mind sharp, how do I keep from losing that my sharpness, my memory, I want to focus a little bit on cognitive decline and the benefits of exercise for cognitive decline. Okay. So first of all, what's the biologic plausibility? Oxidative stress and inflammation contribute to cognitive impairment, and exercise results in increased anti-inflammatory cytokines and decreased pro-inflammatory cytokines. And we have some clinical data to further showcase this concept. This study was published in JAMA, or the Journal of American Medical Association. The object was to determine whether physical activity reduces the rate of cognitive decline among older adults. Participants were volunteers older than 50 with concerns about memory without significant cognitive impairment on screening. The methods were participants were randomly assigned to either a physical activity program, which was a 24-week in-home intense 150 minutes per week program, or usual care. I should note that both groups, however, did get exposure to education materials on exercise. So both groups got some type of intervention. And the authors, or the studiers, and measured cognitive function using quantitative scales. I should mention that the scales they used were not scales that we often use in clinical practice, however. They were scales that are used more in the study setting. And the results, it was relatively small. There were 170 participants. However, after 18 months, they did see a benefit in cognition for the adults who received the physical activity intervention versus no intervention. So it was at least promising. And again, as you'll see a theme for my recommendations, we're looking at a lot of high, when you look from a risk-benefit perspective, it's hard to find, we think, much risk in a lot of recommendations regarding exercise, yet the benefit data, though it may be flawed, is plentiful. Okay, the second study on the same topic I wanted to share was a much bigger one. And this was, again, the object was to investigate association of physical activity with dementia. And this was actually development of dementia. I forgot to mention for the previous study, they actually just looked at scores on the cognitive testing and looked at a difference in the scores for the intervention group versus the usual care, and there was a little bit of a difference in how they scored in terms of numbers, but there wasn't an actual diagnosis of a disease or of a condition involved with this study. The study I wanted to talk about next was actually to investigate association with physical activity with a diagnosis of dementia, of Alzheimer's disease. The participants were 1,880 community-dwelling adults without dementia, and the methods were standardized neurologic and neuropsychologic measures being administered every 1.5 years between 1992 and 2006, and a measured association with physical activity with development of the new diagnosis of dementia. So this was a cohort study, and therefore it was looking over time at how, just marking, getting collection mainly by patient report of physical activity along with their administered cognitive testing. And the results, they had 282 cases of dementia that were diagnosed. And again, higher physical activity was independently associated with reduced risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. I wanted to move on to improvement in longevity. So this study was published in 2009 in JAMA Internal Medicine, or Journal of American Medical Association, the Internal Medicine section. And again, the object of this study was to study the effect of physical activity levels on survival and function. Adults were 70 to 85 years old, and the methods were looking at physical activity data collected for participants over time. They found that the frequency of falls, fractures, and chronic joint or musculoskeletal pain were consistently lower among physically active participants. At baseline, there was improved mortality for physically active versus sedentary participants, and for previously sedentary participants who initiated physical activity, there was a significant benefit in 3-year survival and function. So to show you some numbers to represent that finding, I'll start with orienting you to the graph. So the y-axis shows survival, and the x-axis shows follow-up in years. Can everyone still hear me? I know I'm wandering off the mic. Sorry. Okay. And each of the lines represents degree of exercise, essentially. So the more solid line represents consistent. The dashed line low, this one, decreased level of exercise, and this one was increased level of exercise. So I hope you can tell, but the areas that are more flat on the curve, which correspond to a better survival, are those that are either consistent in exercise or the group that increased in exercise. And in the 80 to 85-year-old age group, they actually got close to the same level, the consistent or increased, whereas the groups that had a low or decreased level of exercise had a curve that downshifted essentially on the survival. So, of course, limitations of the study would be that there could be reverse causality. That's one of the things that authors do mention. It is very possible that physical activity was serving as a proxy for good health. So those who were healthier in the first place were the ones who were able to be, or had a higher chance of longevity, were more likely to be more active. So that could be a potential problem. However, association with survival remains significant after adjustment for comorbidities, functional status, and self-rated health status. So it's still, I think, very interesting, and begs to the point that it's never too late to start exercise. Okay. Specific recommendations for physical activity. The American Heart Association and the American College of Sports Medicine recommend the following for adults over age 65. Aerobic activity, 30 minutes of moderate to intense exercise, 5 days a week. What I always counsel patients is, of course, that's relative to somebody's baseline. So in moderate to intense has no one specific definition, but that's relative to what somebody, if somebody's very sedentary, for instance, then I wouldn't suddenly go to 30 minutes of running on the treadmill. So common sense, but in practice, something we try to make realistic goals of. These are less specified, strength training in terms of specifics, strength training, flexibility training. There is a suggestion of at least 10 minutes of stretching on the days when aerobic or muscle strengthening is performed. Balance training, specifically static balance training and dynamic balance training such as Tai Chi would be an example there. There's quite a bit of data that I'm not going to go into at this particular time regarding Tai Chi and fall risk. So that's one of the big areas of studies. All right, so that was sort of what I the the details I wanted to share in terms of exercise for prevention, and hopefully I've made a case for exercise with data as well as common sense. And I wanted to move on to diet and some of the data we have out there in terms of diet and primary prevention. The areas I wanted to focus on within diet are foods with omega-3 fatty acids, fruits and vegetables, and the Mediterranean diet. So let's start with foods with omega-3 fatty acids. They're commonly found in oily fish like salmon and flaxseed oil. Omega-3 fatty acids are essential for neurocognitive development and normal brain functioning, and that's sort of the biologic plausibility for why we even historically underwent studying omega-3 fatty acids in this context. I specifically, again, I focus a lot on sort of cognitive impairment and dementia because it's often asked of me. So this is a study that looks at fish, meat, and risk of dementia. The authors wanted to evaluate whether there's a relation between consumption of fish, which is high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, or meat, high in saturated fatty acids, and risk of dementia. This is one of the earlier studies, but I wanted to include it as it contrasts with some of the more recent studies. Participants were adults older than 68 years old, and they monitored frequency of consumption of meat and fish, of seafood, and performance on a mini mental status exam over time. And I will point out that the mini mental status exam is actually one that we use clinically, so that's sort of nice as opposed to just one that's for study purposes. Participants who ate fish or seafood at least once a week had significantly lower risk of being diagnosed with dementia, and there was no significant association between meat consumption and risk of dementia. I will say a limitation would be co-founding factors. In this particular study, the authors mention a significant co-founding factor of patients who ate fish and seafood at least once a week were also more likely to be more highly educated. So that's co-founding variables are always a problem with cohort design studies because we're not controlling the environment. We're just essentially observing the environment and whatever factors that we want to observe and the outcome that we are studying. So in this case, that could have been a factor. The next one I wanted to present is fish consumption and cognitive decline with age in a large community study. Similar to the previous study and the fact that it was a cohort design, a little bit more recent, and they actually used four different cognitive tests. They included adults over 64. They measured weekly consumption of fish. Oh, and I didn't put this in the slide, but they actually included not just self-report by patients and food diaries, which is a common way that these types of studies are done, but also included it was a controlled setting where there was some involvement of administration of food. So they were actually able to look at food administration in that way and have correlate data, not just patient report. And fish intake in this setting was also associated with the slower rate of cognitive decline by those four cognitive tests that they used. And finally, I wanted to include, so my outcome this time is not just cognitive decline, but actually total mortality in older adults. This was published in Annals in 2013. And I found this very interesting because it's unique to the other studies I presented in that it was actually a measure of blood levels. So let me go through step by step. The authors sought to investigate associations of omega-3 levels with total and cause-specific mortality among healthy older adults not receiving supplements. The participants were 2,692 U.S. adults aged 70 to 79 years old without coronary heart disease, stroke, or heart failure at baseline. They measured the phospholipid fatty acid levels and cardiovascular risk factors in 1992 and then assessed the relationship with total and cause-specific mortality in 2008. So the study spanned over about 16 years and actually looked at blood levels. And the results were that higher blood levels of the omega-3 biomarkers were associated with lower total mortality. There were fewer cardiovascular than non-cardiovascular deaths. And individuals in the highest quintile of omega-3 level lived an average of 2.2 more years after age 65 than those in the lowest. So I thought that was pretty interesting because it actually, again, was not it was based on blood levels. Now, of course, a possible limitation cited by the authors was that there could be temporal changes in that fatty acid level measurement. So it might be that there's some variation in when it would be highest in measurement, but they think that was likely not a major factor. Okay, so we're on to a basic that I think all of our mothers have told us, fruits and vegetables, mothers and fathers. But what's the data behind it? I wanted to share some of the studies. So again, the biologic plausibility, oxidative stress, and inflammation contribute to cognitive impairment. Fruits and vegetables have antioxidant properties. That's the basis of why we think there may be associations with decreased cognitive change. The first study I'm presenting looked at the association between rates of cognitive change and dietary consumption of fruits and vegetables among older people. It included adults over 64 years old. Participants completed a food frequency questionnaire and completed at least two cognitive assessments, and they found that high vegetable consumption was associated with lower rate of cognitive decline. In this particular study, fruit consumption was not associated with cognitive change, but the jury's not out because the next study, and a more recent study that I wanted to talk about, was published in 2012, where they looked at the intake of berries in relation to cognitive decline to evaluate whether greater long-term intake of berries was associated with a slower rate of cognitive decline in women. The participants were women older than 70 years old with no history of stroke, and they collected dietary assessments with food frequency questionnaires and administered six cognitive tests. The results were that greater intake of blueberries and strawberries were associated with slower rates of cognitive decline. So, again, from the risk-benefit perspective, I have a very hard time, other than maybe the sugar and diabetes, but having reasons not to advocate for berries. So, okay. And finally, the Mediterranean diet. So what exactly is the Mediterranean diet? From a study perspective, it varies slightly from study to study, their definitions. But the general idea, and what's generally included, is a propensity of vegetables, legumes, fruits, and whole grains, oil, olive oil, and in terms of meats, really, red meats and sweets are very small amounts, and the fish, in terms of the proteins, is going to be a bigger proportion. The first paper I wanted to present is, again, sort of, and I should point out that the Mediterranean diet in some ways is sort of a combination of some of those individual components that I talked about before. So rich in omega-3 fatty acids, rich in fruits, vegetables, etc. So this study sought to investigate the association of the Mediterranean diet with change in cognitive performance and risk for dementia. It included 1,410 adults over 65 years old without dementia and measured adherence to the Mediterranean diet and cognitive performance over a five-year period in four different neuropsychologic tests. And again, there's a theme. That's why I'm presenting these, and that's why I sort of like this data, even though it obviously has flaws. There's a higher adherence to Mediterranean diet was associated with a slower decline on one of the neuropsychologic tests, which was the mini mental status. It wasn't on all four tests, so that could be considered a limitation, of course. But the mini mental status exam was one where it was significant, and I did include another outcome as well, not just memory, in terms of primary prevention with cardiovascular disease. This was just in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2013. That's one of our highest impact journals in medicine. So this study was to investigate the association of Mediterranean diet with cardiovascular risk, and it was a very big study, 7,557 adults age 55 to 80 with no cardiovascular disease at baseline. Participants were randomized to one of three types of diets: a Mediterranean diet supplemented with extra virgin olive oil, a Mediterranean diet supplemented with mixed nuts, or a control diet. And the primary endpoint was rate of major cardiovascular events, such as myocardial infarction or heart attack, stroke, or death from any from other cardiovascular disease. The Mediterranean diet supplemented with extra virgin olive oil or nuts reduced the incidence of major cardiovascular events, and I forgot to put the number in, but it was a hazards ratio of, I think, 0.7. The trial was stopped after 4.8 years on the basis of this results based on an interim analysis. So this is before the study was supposed to finish because they were so convinced that these results looked good that they didn't want to keep people in a group that had less benefit than the other group. So that was this was pretty compelling when it came out. Okay, and we'll move on to immunizations. So I started by just putting up what the CDC, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with or have gone to the CDC website, but that's where many of us look for practice guidelines regarding immunization. So this is from the CDC website. It's a recommended adult immunization schedule for 2014. I'll review these briefly, and then my plan was to really focus on new recommendations or new data within immunizations as opposed to going through the past sort of established recommendations. So as many of you are probably are familiar, influenza yearly, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, or Tdap, every 10 years. Or, well, actually, the tetanus part, the pertussis part you only need once, and then from then on you just do a tetanus booster. Varicella, twice, but usually by over 65, everybody has had those. Zoster vaccination over 60, and the pneumococcal polysaccharide, PPSV23, one dose, and you'll see there is sort of a new recommendation on this, as well as thoughts or studies regarding the high dose versus standard dose influenza vaccine. I'll share those with you in just a minute. So some updates and immunization recommendations. So in August of 2014, a relatively large, in that same high-impact journal, New England Journal of Medicine, paper came out showing the efficacy of high-dose influenza vaccine in older adults. And in September of 2014, there was a recommendation for pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, or PCV13, to be used in addition to PPSV23, which was the standard recommendation up until this came out. Okay, so we'll start by the data on the efficacy of the high-dose, or HD, influenza vaccine, or Fluzone, in older adults. The high-dose vaccine was actually approved by the FDA back in 2009. Clinically, many of us weren't necessarily consistently using it, however, but when this data came out in August 2014, I think there's been a much larger sort of knowledge and use of the high-dose. The study was a large multi-center trial showing improved efficacy for older adults who are immunized with the HD or high dose influenza vaccine compared with standard dose. So there were it was very large. 31,989 participants were enrolled from 126 research centers in the United States and Canada. It was a multi-center, randomized, double-blind, active-controlled trial comparing high dose versus standard dose influenza vaccine. They did assessments of relative efficacy, effectiveness, safety, and immunogenicity. Among patients over 65 years old, the high dose influenza vaccine provided higher antibody response and better protection against laboratory confirmed influenza virus. And I was going to show you some numbers if they show up. This is from the paper to give you some orientation. The two categories here are for laboratory confirmed influenza. The two columns here are culture confirmed influenza. The HD is high dose, the SD is standard dose, and these represent protocol defined influenza like illness. So what the study had defined initially is definition for influenza-like illness, the modified CDC-defined influenza-like illness, and a respiratory symptoms-based. So I'm going to focus just for simplification on this top set of numbers. You can see the protocol-defined influenza-like illness in the high-dose influenza group there were 73 events, or 0.5% of laboratory-confirmed influenza, compared to 113, or 0.7%, which gave a relative efficacy of 35.4%, with a confidence interval, 95% confidence interval of 12.5 to 52.5. So the numbers are sort of in that range, no matter sort of what combination you look at, how it was confirmed, which strains, et cetera. And this actually did break it down by the strain, similar to the vaccine components as well. So that's sort of why you're starting to hear all about the high-dose flu vaccine, Fluzone, for older adults. And here's the results sort of. We talked about that already. The rates of adverse events were similar with the high-dose and standard-dose vaccines, as a side note. I also wanted to mention, and you may have heard of this already, that we do think that one particular strain of the flu vaccine this year is not as effective. So in December of 2014, the CDC released a health advisory stating that over 50% of influenza age, specifically the H3N2 viruses that have been collected and analyzed in the United States between October and November of 2014 were antigenically different or drifted from the H3N2 that was included in the season's influenza vaccines. However, we still recommend it because we think there's some cross-protection against the drifted viruses and that there's protection against the influenza virus. As you saw, actually, vaccine provides protection against other strains. Okay. So I wanted to move on to the recommendation for the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, or the PCV13. Like I had mentioned before, and we saw on the chart from the CDC, previous recommendation was a single administration of the 23-valent pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine for all adults over 65 years old. In September of 2014, the AICP, which is the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, revised the recommendation to include the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, or the PCV13, for all adults over 65 years old. What that recommendation was based on was a little bit hard for me to find, actually, because the data hasn't been published yet in the traditional way that we look up. It's in PubMed. I couldn't find the paper that led to this change in recommendation. However, there were it was based really on this study done in, I believe, the Netherlands, and they had data that was presented in abstract and presentation form to the CDC, and the paper is soon to be released. So I did the best I could to try to find out what was behind that recommendation. There were 84,000 adults who were included in the study over 65 years old. It was a randomized placebo-controlled trial, and the participants received the PCV13 or placebo. And there was a suggested efficacy that the PCV13 against the vaccine type invasive pneumococcal disease. In the consequent documents I've seen, it sounds as if they think this immunity may not last long. It may be a short-term added benefit. However, because of the herd immunity effect, if we do this on a population level, we think we'll be able to decrease pneumonia incidence. Okay. So we're on to secondary prevention, which again is focusing on early detection and treatment of asymptomatic disease. So the examples of that I wanted to include are cancer screening, osteoporosis screening, and abdominal aortic aneurysm screening. So we'll start with cancer screening. So we'll start with colorectal cancer screening. What are the recommendations for patients over 75 years old? Well, it sort of depends who you ask. The guidelines do differ. I included two different guidelines just to give a sense of what you may see out there. The ACS-MSTF-ACR stands for the American Cancer Society, U.S. Multitask Force on Colorectal Cancer, and the American College of Radiology. They've come together to create recommendations, and they recommend, and I didn't go into the details of which method of screening for the purposes of this talk. I wanted to think more about when, how do you continue, do you stop? So they suggested you screen over 50, and the frequency depends on the method of screening, and give no sense of a stop age. The only organization that I'm aware of that currently gives a stop age, or a, I guess, think about it age, would be the USPSTF, which is United States Services Preventative Task Force, who recommend against routine screening for patients age 76 to 85, but may consider in an individual patient, and they recommend against screening in patients over 85, because at that point they really consider that the harms are greater than the benefit. Why do we even think about a stop age, or why do we think about stopping? Partially because preventative interventions usually have delayed benefit and potential for immediate risk. So what do I mean by that? What do I mean by a delayed benefit for a preventive measure? So where does that come from? So for example, for colorectal screening and mortality, the y-axis here represents colorectal death per 1,000, and the x-axis represents years. For a screened population, which is the red line, versus a control or an unscreened population, the blue line, you'll see that the curves don't begin to separate in a statistically significant way until about year somewhere between 8 and 10. Okay, so that means that if I'm ordering a screening test for a patient, in specifically colorectal cancer screening, and actually breast cancer screening has a similar trajectory, that patient should have at least 8 to 10 or 5 to 10 years in front of him or her. And I would say we tend to be conservative and say at least 5, because if somebody doesn't have, in our estimation, at least 5 years of life expectancy, then we probably aren't going to get the benefit from the screening test, and we may actually be doing more harm than good. Because I was on the subject of colon cancer screening, I wanted to just briefly talk about, well, what about when you have polyps and polyps have been removed? Because that's technically not a screening test anymore. It's considered surveillance. And this question comes up all the time, because we don't follow the recommendations for primary screening, then we need to have some other source of guidelines to look at. Unfortunately, at this point, we don't really have any expert guidelines for surveillance of patients with history of treated adenomatous polyps that specifically address when, if ever, surveillance colonoscopy should stop. So that's still something that I think is maybe coming. I wanted to share what we do have, which are the standard recommendations without going into grave detail, but if somebody has no polyps, or hyperplastic polyps in their rectum or sigmoid, then we just repeat the colonoscopy in 10 years. If neoplasia is found, it depends on what type of adenoma, and then the frequency of surveillance is recommended accordingly. However, like I said, there's no sense of do we keep doing this forever? At some point, do we stop? Does it matter? There was a recent study, and that's what I wanted to lead into, that was just published in 2014, again in JAMA Internal Medicine, on the topic of surveillance colonoscopy in elderly patients. The authors wanted to investigate the relative impact of surveillance colonoscopy. They studied 4,834 patients over age 75 and 22,929 patients in a reference group who were 50 to 74 years old. And it was a retrospective cohort study where the patients were followed from their surveillance examination until the outcome of either colorectal cancer diagnosis, death, disenrollment, IBD diagnosis, or a study end date. And they found that there was an overall lower incidence of colorectal cancer in the patients over 75. So not that patients over 75 have a lower incidence of colorectal cancer, but they have a lower incidence if we're just doing surveillance for polyps. So that's interesting and something to keep in mind when we're thinking about, do we do this forever? And there was a relatively higher rate of post-procedure hospitalization among elderly patients undergoing surveillance colonoscopy. So more chance of side effects or risks of the procedure itself. So again, we don't have really kind of national guidelines yet on this topic, but it is something that comes up clinically all the time, and we talk about risks and benefits and sort of think about it in an individual way. Okay, so what about breast cancer screening? For patients over 75 years old, the USPSTF gives us what an I statement. So that is their way of saying there's insufficient evidence, that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the benefits and harms of screening mammography in women over 75 years old. So what does that mean in terms of clinical care? Really, it's more individualization of care. So we look at things like risks and benefits, patient preference, life expectancy. So that's how I interpret the I statement. Potential benefit to screening for women over 75 years old is breast cancer is still a leading cause of death in older women. Potential harms for screening in women over 75 is overdiagnosis, and that's one of the, on the harm section, the essentially detection of cancer that would never have become clinically apparent. And that's a phenomenon that we're seeing described commonly as well. And along with overdiagnosis often leads to overtreatment and the potential side effects that can come with that. On this topic, though, I always also like to make sure we talk about the potential for underscreening, because one of my concerns about age-based recommendations is the group that is on that very robust longevity side who may have over 10 years in front of him or her, even if she is in the 75 or 76 plus age group. Sometimes I have trainees or other groups with me who say, oh, well, over 75, we don't need to do it anymore. I said, well, that's not exactly what the guideline is saying, or even what makes sense from a medical and from a scientific standpoint. There are patients who may, if they have plenty of years, and if she has plenty of years in front of her, it almost doesn't matter what her specific age is. If she is interested, there is still potential for benefit from screening. So absolutely, we don't want to overscreen, but we don't want to underscreen either. It's all about appropriate screening. Okay. Oh, I included this to sort of summarize. Breast cancer screening is one of the more, controversial, yes, especially in the younger ages, but even in the older ages, there's more variation in what you see in the recommendations. So I told you about USPSTF. There's American College of Gynecology, Obstetrician and Gynecology, women over who don't give a stop age or a think about it age. ACS similarly doesn't. And I really wanted to share our American Geriatric Society statement on this topic, as I think it really encompasses everything I was trying to say in one discrete statement. Screening over age 85 reserved for women most likely to benefit by virtue of excellent health and functional status, and those who feel strongly that they will benefit from such screening either in peace of mind or improved quality of life. So, okay, and the last two, cervical cancer screening is probably the least controversial of all, as the recommendations are pretty consistent through the different organizations. So the USPSTF recommends pap smears every 3 years for women age 21 to 65 years old. That's with the caveat that women have had previously negative pap smears and that has not had a history of any type of uterine or cervical cancer. And no new risk factors or new concerns. The American Cancer Society has a similar recommendation, recommends that women over age 65 who have had regular screenings with normal results should not be screened for cervical cancer. And prostate cancer screening is absolutely one of the more controversial areas. The USPSTF in 2012 updated the recommendation to suggest that to say that men should not be screened for prostate cancer at all. I wanted to include what the ACP suggests, which is the ACP recommends individual discussion of risks and benefits for prostate cancer screening, and they also suggest that men 50 to 69 years old are most likely to benefit from screening. Without going too much into this highly heated topic, I would say that the similar concepts apply to what I mentioned in terms of both overdiagnosis bias, the chance of detecting a cancer that would never be apparent or worrisome to a patient in the lifespan, and also the possible the problems with having side effects and problems with treatments from overdiagnosis. Those are the main reasons, really, and the test is not thought to be really specific enough. They think there's a lot of false positives. So those are some of the reasons that it's controversial and that the USPTSF updated their guidelines. Okay, osteoporosis and osteopenia screening. USPTSF recommends screening with bone densitometry routinely for women over 65. Over 60, if increased risk for osteoporotic fractures, and I'm going to share next some ways to look at risk for fracture, and concludes insufficient evidence for benefit versus harm for screening routinely in men. That I included, again, two organizations because, again, it sort of depends where you look to. The more, I would say, the more aggressive organization, the National Osteoporosis Foundation, recommends routine screen for women over age 65 and men over age 70. So it's all sort of how you look at the data in terms of what, how you weigh risk versus benefit. Screen younger postmenopausal women or women in menopausal transition or men 50 to 69 with clinical risk factors for fracture or adults who have a fracture after age 50. This was the tool I was referring to. It's called the Fracture Risk Assessment Tool, or FRACS. It's very regularly used, especially when deciding on somebody's risk factor for risk factors for fracture. It was first introduced by the WHO in 2008. It estimates a 10-year probability of hip fracture and major osteoporotic fracture for untreated patients age 40 to 90 years old. It's based upon data collected from large prospective observational studies of men and women of different ethnicities in world regions, and it's validated in 11 independent cohorts. You can Google this, and you can find the calculator and type in the information and sort of get that 10-year probability. Oh, this was to remind myself to plug for calcium and vitamin D and sort of some of the intricacies involved with that. It could have gone in the diet section, but I thought I'd put it here because of the relationship with osteoporosis and fall risk, really. Calcium recommendations are approximately 1,200 milligrams a day, and you might be aware of recent data about increased calcifications on imaging in the arteries and vasculature, so potential concern that there could be increased cardiovascular events with those increased calcifications. So we're very particular that when I counsel patients, the 1,200 milligrams a day should include food sources as well. So if you're eating a lot of yogurt and milk and cheese, look at that as well. So if you're, for instance, one cup of yogurt has approximately 400 milligrams of calcium. So if you're getting that much in the calcium in the yogurt that you're eating, then you don't need to supplement the 1,200 milligrams because we don't want to overdo it with calcium either. And then the vitamin D, the standard recommendation is 1,000 international units, 1 to 2,000 international units daily, unless somebody has an actual vitamin D deficiency in which we might change what we prescribe in terms of dosage in the regimen. Okay, and finally, abdominal aortic aneurysm screening. Screening for AAA with a one-time abdominal ultrasound has been shown to decrease aneurysm-related deaths and all-cause mortality in men. This recommendation is also fairly straightforward and consistent among different organizations. Both the USPSTF and the AHA recommend a one-time ultrasound screening for men aged 65 to 75 who have ever smoked. Because the prevalence of AAA is lower in women, screening has not been shown to be effective in women. So we really only do that for men. Okay, so that sort of ties up what I wanted to present in terms of what I think the pearls are for primary and secondary prevention. There's one other really big topic that's important for health promotion that doesn't fit neatly into any other category that I wanted to briefly discuss, and that's polypharmacy, or inappropriate drug prescribing. That's something that we see every day, really, in geriatric medicine, and I wanted to share some of the studies and data that go along with it. 75% of office visits by older adults or older patients are associated with continuation or initiation of a drug prescription. 66% of men and 81% of women over 65 use at least one prescription drug weekly. And 12.5% of men and 25% of women over 65 use five or more prescription drugs weekly. 12% of older adults use 10 or more over-the-counter medications weekly. In terms of adverse drug events in the elderly, in 2007 to 2009, there were 99,628 emergency hospitalizations for adverse drug events in individuals over 65. A meta-analysis found a four-fold increase in the rate of hospitalization related to adverse drug events in older adults compared with younger adults. And approximately 88% of the adverse drug event hospitalizations among older adults were thought to be preventable, compared to 24% among the younger adults. I also wanted to describe something called the prescribing cascade. It's probably something that you have seen or experienced or heard of, but or maybe not, but it's something that happens all the time, and we're really try to be cognizant of it. It occurs when a new drug is prescribed to treat symptoms from an unrecognized adverse drug event related to an existing therapy. So for instance, somebody's given one drug. That person has a side effect, but it's interpreted as a new condition and therefore given a second drug and then has another side effect. And that's one of the ways that we end up with polypharmacy or inappropriate prescribing. I wanted to give an example, and this has actually also been studied in the literature a little bit. A common one that I see is a prescription for cholinesterase inhibitor, which like donepezil or a memory medication, may cause diarrhea or incontinence, and then is treated with a prescription for an anticholinergic agent like oxybutynin or ditropan to treat incontinence. So this is a perfect example. You've got your first drug, which is donepezil, and the adverse drug effect, which is interpreted as a new medical condition, is the urinary incontinence, followed by a second drug, the oxybutynin, and this is an anticholinergic agent, so this can actually lead to higher risk of falls, fracture, etc. So this is a common and something we really want to try to prevent and think about, and part of the reason I felt the need to talk about this phenomenon. So what's an example of some of the, and this happens, I guess, is the point of this study. A retrospective cohort study in Canada found that the risk of treatment with medicine for urinary incontinence was greater for patients who had received a cholinesterase inhibitor with a hazards ratio of 1.53%. So this is just a framework I wanted to put out there. They're again, sort of common sense questions, but sometimes it's hard to think through all of these in this way, and it can be really helpful to think through this when you're looking at polypharmacy or evaluating a medication list for yourself or a loved one or a friend. Is there an indication for the drug? Is the medication effective for the condition? Is the dosage correct? Are the directions correct? Are the directions practical? Are there clinically significant drug-drug interactions? Are there clinically significant drug-disease interactions? Is there unnecessary duplication with other drugs? Is the duration of therapy acceptable? So just a framework to try to think about. Hopefully, between these questions, we should be able to get at some of the earlier issues I mentioned. And then just a few words of caution on supplements and herbs. They have the same potential for adverse reactions and side effects as drugs, but there's less testing and less regulation. They don't have to prove efficacy before marketing. They don't have ongoing monitoring of purity or composition of ingredients, and there is limited knowledge of interactions with prescription medications. So that brings me to the summary, which is pretty simple, but hopefully you feel convinced. All good recommendations. Stay active. Eat a balanced diet. Consider new immunization guidelines. Consider benefits versus risks of screening tests, and regularly evaluate appropriateness of medication use. That's it. So the one with the mortality, or with the cardiovascular events, that study with the three arms. Yeah, so the third one was, so it's interesting you bring that up. The third arm, this was one of the limitations of the study because they actually had to change the protocol like within, I think, 2 years or something of the study for that usual group. And they didn't have any, they weren't getting any sort of intervention at all. It was just the other two with the nuts and the oil and the Mediterranean diet. So that third group, there was the thought that they were, because they were getting a complete lack of intervention, that it was not an appropriate control group. So they actually started giving them some intervention, but it wasn't Mediterranean specific, it was just more about low fat and kind of healthy eating habits. And so the question, I think, is what my thoughts are on multivitamins. Right, so it sounds as if the question is a diet specifically when you can eat smaller amounts or when you're not eating the same amount. So I'm not aware of specific data for that specific question, but what I could say just based on my experience in clinical care would be one way to, I don't know if you are a fan of doing the juices, where you can kind of, because you can get a lot more in drinking sometimes than eating, and so sometimes you can do a lot of the vegetables and fruit in a juice form, and that would be one way I would just anecdotally suggest you might be able to. That's true. The fiber would be decreased. Yeah. One thing I would say, though, specific to the multivitamin comment is, you know, there's, as I'm sure many of you have read and are aware of, so much controversy now about vitamins and do they really give the benefit they're supposed to, or are they more harmful than beneficial? And what my take on that has been is really I worry more about when there's long lists of vitamins, and that's okay. It just needs to be carefully evaluated. And I think a single multivitamin is probably not going to cause more harm than benefit, in my opinion. What the CDC is recommending is doing the PCV13 at any point now. So I should have put this one up. If you've had the pneumonia vaccine, the 23, after age 65, then 6 to 12 months later, they're recommending getting the PCV13. So if it's over that, that's fine. If it's been 3 years since you've had your 23, then they would say, according to the recommendations, and again, with the caveat, this is very new. This is as September of 2014, but they're suggesting that you do get that PCV13 for a little bit better protection.
Is that another shot?
Yeah. It's another shot, and most of the pharmacies have it, so you can get it done anywhere. And they should all be aware of this recommendation as well. It shouldn't be foreign to anybody in the pharmacies.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.